Welcome, everybody. It's a great day here at the Trust Ampersand Podcast. We have a special guest today, Nicole Ballastreri from our marketing group.
Hi.
Welcome, Nicole.
Hi, Reed. Thank you. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
Tell everybody about yourself and what you do at Ampersand.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, as you mentioned, my name is Nicole Ballastreri. I am Director of Marketing and Communications here at Ampersand. So just touching all aspects of our business, and I'm really excited today to talk about something kind of near and dear to my heart, which is history a bit, as well as regulation and regulatory policy, which is actually quite exciting.
It really is. Well, there's been a lot of buzz about FDIC insurance, raising FDIC insurance limits, and that's what we're here to talk about today. And this really started, I think, it became a front page topic after the Silicon Valley debacle a little over a year ago, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And, you know, then we saw several other high profile bank failures thereafter. And even recently into this year, we had banks like New York Community Bank come close to the edge, right? If not for a group of investors that stepped in to really help out, we may have had another.
And it's funny because as I travel around and talk to folks, there's mixed views on whether people should be paying attention to FDIC insurance limits. You know, some folks say banks never fail. Other folks are super worried about it. In any event, you spearheaded a survey that we did to kind of find this out firsthand, right? What depositors care about.
Yeah.
Maybe touch for the audience, maybe touch on that briefly.
Sure.
And what we learned.
Sure. So in our 2023 depositor priority survey, we talked with key financial decision makers from a variety of industries, as well as experts from, you know, top financial institutions. And from the depositor side, something that we saw is bank failure is still on people's minds. I think it's over half of respondents to the survey indicate that as they look towards the future, bank failure is still a top concern when they think about their deposit management and their cash management strategies. So I think we would be remiss as, you know, folks in this field to think that, well, you know, consumers or depositors, you know, a bank failure happens. Yes, it's scary, especially for those impacted, but it's not really a top concern for others. No, it definitely is.
Yep. And it's still a concern. And so, you know, but a lot of people probably really don't understand FDIC insurance and really don't understand how it works. So maybe today we can spend a few minutes on all of those details, but let's start with the history of it. You said you were a history buff, so tell us how it all came to be.
Yeah, so when you think about the creation of the FDIC, it's important to understand the time frame in which it happened. So we were in the U.S. post-World War I. We were in the middle of the Great Depression. There were an average of more than 600 banks that failed per year between 1921 and 1929.
Wow.
So we were in the middle of a lot of financial turmoil in the U.S. I mean, that was like bread lines and, you know, people were losing jobs left and right, you know, the Dust Bowl, all of that, right? And so bank runs were very, very common. And so it was FDR in 1933 that signed essentially the law that created the FDIC, you know, signed it into law. He signed that bill into law. It was part of the Banking Act of 1933. So really, you know, among all of the other great things that he did, he really wanted to focus on how to protect the U.S. banking system in doing that. And believe it or not, in some of my research, you know, originally the concept of the FDIC and the idea that banks would fund like their own kind of insurance, right? And we'll get more into that, was not popular at first. People were kind of like, why is the government getting involved in this? It wasn't as kind of a home run as you would think. But yes, it was a, the FDIC was established to basically improve consumer confidence in the wake of all of these bank failures and just a really poor economy.
Because I guess before that, if you were in one of those bread lines, and I can remember seeing pictures of those, historic pictures of those, if you weren't close enough to the front of that line,
yeah,
you probably didn't have any money at the end of what, right, when you finally got to the bank, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, I mean, that was when we started to, you know, see people, like, they'd get money and they'd stash it in the mattress, right? You know, because bank trust was at an absolute, was at an absolute all-time low. And right, the early FDIC, their primary focus was creating what I would like term an MVP, a minimum viable product, to really just ensure that customers were protected. It was all about making sure that there was capital adequacy within our banks, and then working on building up that deposit insurance fund to cover consumers in the event of a bank failure. So it really kind of started from that ground floor to help protect the average person.
And did it cover all of their deposits, or has there always been kind of a limit to it?
No, there's always been a limit, and that limit has changed and grown kind of in accordance with the average deposit account amount in the U.S. So it is currently $250,000 per tax ID per covered institution in the U.S. in the event of a failure. And that was established as the amount in, or the limit, in 2010. Prior to that, on March 31st of 1980, they raised the amount to $100,000. So it's kind of gone all the way from at its inception, $2,500, all the way up to $250,000 today.
Okay. And then how does it work? So is it per person $250,000?
Yeah.
Per bank account $250,000? How does it work?
So FDIC insurance coverage is extended per tax ID per institution. So that means that if I, Nicole, have a bank account at, let's say, US Bank or Wells Fargo, I am covered under my Social Security number, which is, in the eyes of the federal government, my tax ID number, up to $250,000 at that institution as a whole. I cannot open multiple bank accounts and have additional coverage at my same institution. If I have more than $250,000 and I want to take advantage of FDIC protection, what I need to do is go to a different institution or work with a cash management services provider like we are at Ampersand in order to achieve that.
Right. Okay, very good. So how does it work? Where does the money come from to provide this insurance?
So FDIC insurance for depositors comes from the Deposit Insurance Fund. The Deposit Insurance Fund is a fund created and funded, well, it's managed by the FDIC, but it is created by the banks themselves. So every year, banks receive or have to take an examination, usually a state examination. And they also, you know, have to report on their, you know, liquidity, their safety and soundness, and things like call reports and so on. And so as part of this examination, a bank is assigned a CAMELS rating. And this is just essentially a score, to kind of sum it all up, that identifies the safety and soundness of this bank. So how safe is this bank for a depositor when they put their money there? Now, the more at risk a bank is, so let's say they have less capital adequacy or whatever, they end up paying more in their assessment fee to the Deposit Insurance Fund. So the bank takes the assessment, and then that assessment notes how much they owe into the Deposit Insurance Fund. So if I'm an at-risk bank, I'm going to end up paying more into that fund to kind of cover off on my potential shocks to the system that my institution may create. So then that fund exists and is managed by the FDIC to protect depositors in the event of a bank failure.
That makes a lot of sense. Sort of the same way I would imagine car insurance works. If you have car accidents all the time, it's probably more expensive for you to pay those premiums than it is for somebody that's a lower risk. So yeah. The size of the bank and the risk of the bank all contribute to how much they have to pay ultimately.
Ultimately, it is actually, so I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to mention, size of the bank is actually not a factor. So it's all it's all about the CAMELS rating, which, so I guess to be specific, you know, size may impact certain elements of the CAMELS rating, right? Sure. If it's a big bank or a community bank, they're all kind of assessed on the same value or the same, same factors, right? So it is actually a topic of discussion amongst people that want to raise FDIC limits is how would that impact actually smaller community banks? Because if a small community bank is assessed in the same way as, let's say, Wells Fargo, and then those assessment fees are not really based on what that bank can shoulder in terms of paying out, it's based just on risk and safety and soundness, that could be burdensome on a small community bank.
Yeah, you're talking about the model they use to assess the banks is common, right?
Yeah.
And that makes sense. Okay, so lots of talk now about the amount being $250,000. Mm-hmm. And is that still an appropriate amount? It's been 15 years since the last raise of capital. And I know you put together a blog recently and have written on this topic.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are your thoughts, first of all? Should the limit be raised? Is that an appropriate thing to be considering?
So I think within certain frameworks and in certain contexts, we could consider increasing the FDIC limit to protect American businesses and depositors. I think it's important to note that, you know, currently there are over $7 trillion of unsecured deposits in our system. So that's an awful lot. And the deposit insurance fund is roughly $120 billion with a B.
Right.
So there is a big delta there between what exists to cover potential loss and what is currently unsecured within the system.
So when you say uncovered, there's $7 trillion, I think you said, of uncovered. Yep. You're saying those are deposit amounts per tax ID that exceed the $250,000 limit. So in the event that the bank that those deposits were in failed, the depositor would not have those deposits covered by insurance.
Correct. And what's interesting is that 99% of U.S. deposit accounts hold less than $250,000. So that's where that limit comes from. So when we kind of put two and two together, who's holding the most in unsecured deposits, it's American businesses. And it's you know, large depositors, right? And so the potential risk of, let's say, your local construction company having $10 million in deposits in a local bank, well, they're employing people in your community, they're running payroll. I mean, that's a big risk for a depositor like that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Back to increasing the limits. So carry on with your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, you know, the FDIC itself did make a recommendation in May of 2023 that limits should be increased on business bank accounts that support payroll. So sort of for the example that I outlined for reasons like that, you know, legislators will periodically, you know, request recommendations from the FDIC. It, you know, is brought up in different hearings. Should we be doing this? Why should we be doing this? Why should we not be doing it? You know, I think when we look at what consumers want, we covered that, right? They're concerned about bank safety and security. We covered the risk of unsecured deposits in the system and the fact that the current deposit insurance fund doesn't cover it. So I think it, you know, it makes sense to say, yeah, we need to look at these possible solutions, but there are there's two sides to every coin, right? So it's not as simple as saying, yep, increase the limits, let's do $1 million. Well, that money has to come from somewhere. And as we mentioned, it comes from the banks themselves. So when we talk about a small community bank or Wells Fargo, everybody's paying in based on the risk they contribute to the system. So they should be incentivized to not be contributing risk to the system. But as we know, in the economy, things are up and down, right? So a small community bank may not be able to handle that increased assessment fee that they would be given. And then what happens if they can't pay it? So that could be a huge problem because our community banks are vital and necessary for the success of the U.S. economy. So when we talk about raising the limit, we need to take all of these things into consideration. And that's where the discussion about maybe it's certain types of accounts, or maybe it's for, you know, a specific period of time, right? So essentially what we could do, or a potential solution could be, to look at providing increased coverage on maybe business operating accounts that are non-interest bearing. So that could be a way that we could address that.
Okay, that makes sense. And that would have helped significantly in the Silicon Valley concern, where it's a lot of business accounts basically, and companies are concerned about ability to make payroll and so on. The other thing about it, I think, is that deposits generally are, you know, deposits are the lifeblood of banks. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing for a bank to be able to do is to, when a depositor comes in to withdraw a deposit, be able to give them their money.
Correct.
However, as you know, we know banks lend that money out to others, right? And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, you know, if we sort of said, all right, FDIC limits are unlimited, so whatever you have in there is covered. Mm-hmm. Might that affect how banks behave?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in that instance that, you know, banks have a lower incentive to be careful with their loan profiles, right? So they're going to take risks. They're going to move fast and break things. They don't have to be as cautious when they know that essentially their potential poor behavior is going to be covered by the FDIC or the U.S. government, right? So we need to take all of these things into consideration. And, you know, there was a point in time when there was a program granted by the FDIC to kind of cover off on more deposits. And that was part of the Transaction Account Guarantee Program. And it was part of the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, which was established during the financial crisis of 2008, which that did functionally end in 2012, but that provided increased FDIC coverage on some of these account types that we're talking about. So, you know, I think there's a way to kind of thread the needle where we're not saying, okay, everybody, you know, everything's covered, no problem, because then banks are going to say, wow, well, you know, we can take some risks here, right? We don't have to worry about covering depositor funds because, you know, the government's going to take care of that, or the FDIC will. There's a middle ground that we can get to while we still, you know, protect depositors and understand that maybe we need to kind of make those, you know, incremental increases in certain areas.
Yeah, I think that's super smart, because what you're really saying is, you know, it's a complex problem. It can put a tremendous amount of strain on the community bank part of our economy, which is, I agree with you, is vital. Going the other way, it can incent bad behavior from banks in terms of making loan decisions, which puts depositors' deposits at risk. You know, banks that make bad loans, those deposits are probably more at risk than banks that make good loans, right?
Yeah.
So you want to have both. You want to have money in community banks so that community banks can make loans to communities in need, but you also want prudent behavior on the part of the banks. So perhaps you're right, some sort of surgical, more surgical approach, picking on maybe business operating accounts, non-interest bearing or something, is a way to kind of thread that needle.
Would say, you know, I would say increasing the FDIC limit in specific cases for specific accounts for specific depositors would provide protection to American depositors, workers, businesses, but the amount and the types of deposits needs to be kind of carefully reviewed and understood so that we can be sure that we're threading that needle.
Right. And then one other thing, sort of a little bit off topic, but I know we were talking about this a little bit yesterday. There might be a lot of confusion out there with this emerging sort of fintech companies that talk about FDIC insurance. Mm-hmm. And the audience should really know that a lot of those companies aren't actually banks, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think, you know, as we've seen kind of an explosion and proliferation of different types of apps, right? So you've got the Chimes and the Yada and the I have a really great one that I like. It's called Oportun. It used to be called Digit. It's like a fractional savings app. I love that one. It's
Okay.
important to understand that that's overlying fintech that sits on top of a bank. So the fintech itself is not an FDIC insured product in any capacity. It is simply a mechanism for you to access services that are delivered from an underlying bank. And typically, there is something which we wrote about, you know, recently. Our CEO Kelly Brown had a great piece in American Banker about this. There is a middleware that usually sits between the two of these. There's a very, very big story going on right now with one called Synapse, and that is the way that allow that's the tool that allows the bank and the fintech to kind of communicate back and forth about those customer funds. So, customers really need to be aware. Depositors need to understand that, you know, there's a lot of great tools and bells and whistles and fintechs out there, which is great. And we want that innovation. And we want there to be innovation in the deposit space, especially.
Yep.
But we want
Right.
everybody to understand that that FDIC insurance comes from a qualified, covered institution.
Comes from a bank that is regulated by the FDIC, and these third-party fintech companies are not banks and are not regulated by the FDIC, and their marketing messaging is often quite confusing.
Yeah,
So,
very.
if any listeners out there want to learn more about that, Nicole's a great contact for you to talk to and help can help point you in the right direction for any other information. Okay, and last question,
Yeah.
Nicole, on FDIC as we sort of wrap this up. What do you think lies ahead in terms of depositor thoughts on bank safety going into 2025? I know you're planning to launch another survey. Perhaps you could sort of throw out
Yeah.
a little bit of a trailer on what to expect in that.
Sure. Yeah, so we will be repeating our survey because I think it's important for us to understand over time where are depositors at in terms of their confidence in their banking relationships, in terms of their overall confidence within the banking system as a whole. So we will be, you know, continuing to ask questions about what are depositors looking for from their bank in terms of their relationship? What is important to them in terms of how their cash management, their cash is deployed, you know, from an alignment perspective? But we're also still going to be talking about bank safety and security. And I think, you know, we all live in America in 2024. We're all, you know, consuming news and media. I think economy, bank safety is something that people are still thinking about, they're still worried about. And I expect that we may even see potentially a slight uptick in that concern year over year, just given where things have kind of landed financially for a lot of folks. So that's what I would guess probably. And I think that we need to kind of reach more of a homeostasis and stability within our system overall to give people kind of, you know, increased confidence. And I just don't know that people are there yet. I think people still need to be, you know, on the lookout.
Thank you. And for all the listeners to this podcast, be on the lookout for this upcoming survey. I think it should show some interesting trends, and we'll be happy to invite Nicole back to talk more about the results of that when it's all ready. Thank you, Nicole, for joining us today. Very much appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. And any parting comments for the audience?
No, thank you. This is very interesting. I always enjoy talking about this, and I would encourage anybody that wants to talk more about this or read more about this to visit trustampersand.com. You can read all about this on our blog. You can also reach out to us, and I promise we will get back to you.
Thanks so much.
Thank
Appreciate your time.
you.